The first time I saw Alessandro throw a crystal tumbler against the glass wall of the boardroom, I didn't flinch. None of us did. We just sat there, adjusted our expensive Italian wool blazers, and waited for the shards to stop vibrating. That was the trick with Alessandro. He didn't want you to run for cover. He wanted to see if you were brave enough to stay in the splash zone. He called it friction-based innovation. I called it a slow-motion car crash that we were all being paid six figures to witness. People think leaders want stability, that they want a smooth-running machine where every cog turns in perfect sync. Those people haven't met a man like Alessandro. He didn't want a machine. He wanted a riot that only he knew how to lead. I started at the firm as his right hand, the one person supposed to keep the schedule tight and the clients happy. But you don't manage a man like that. You just survive him. He was a silver-haired shark in a tailored suit, a man who treated a Tuesday morning staff meeting like a high-stakes poker game where the cards were made of our collective sanity. He had this way of walking into a room, chest out, eyes scanning for a weakness that made the air feel thin. It wasn't just power. It was the deliberate, calculated use of instability. He flirted with crisis like it was foreplay. If there wasn't a fire to put out, he'd strike a match and drop it into a waste paper basket just to watch us scramble. He'd call me at 3 in the morning. Not because there was an emergency, but because he wanted to create one. He'd whisper into the phone about a betrayal that hadn't happened yet, or a merger that was supposedly falling apart, planting seeds of doubt that he knew I'd spend the next 12 hours trying to verify. By the time I got to the office, I was vibrating with anxiety, and he'd be sitting there, sipping an espresso, looking at me with this dark, amused glint in his eyes. He loved the tension. He fed on the way our hands shook when we handed him a report. He knew that as long as we were scared, we were looking to him for the solution. He was the arsonist and the only man with a hose. The entanglement wasn't romantic, at least not in the way people usually mean. It was deeper than that. It was an addiction. We were all hooked on the adrenaline he provided. The office was a pressure cooker, and we were the ingredients he kept stirring just to see what would happen when we hit the boiling point. He would pit us against each other with a surgical precision that was honestly kind of beautiful to watch if it wasn't so devastating. He'd tell me that my colleague Marco was gunning for my position, then tell Marco that I was the one leaking his project failures to the board. We'd spend weeks sabotaging each other, fueled by a paranoia that Alessandro curated like a fine wine. And then, when the explosion finally happened, he'd step in as the peacemaker, the only one with the vision to settle the dispute he had manufactured from thin air. I remember one night in Milan, after a particularly brutal round of layoffs that he'd framed as a necessary pruning of the week. We were at a bar that overlooked the Duomo, the kind of place where the drinks cost more than my first car. He leaned in close, the smell of expensive tobacco and vintage grappa clinging to him. And he told me that most people are sheep who crave the fence. He said that a real leader removes the fence and watches which sheep learn to fight. He looked at me then, his eyes tracking the pulse in my neck. And I realized he didn't just love the chaos. He loved me because I was the only one who had started to enjoy the fire as much as he did. That was the turning point. I started to see the strings. I realized that the crises we were navigating were almost entirely fictional. The lost contracts, he'd ghosted the clients on purpose. The regulatory audits, he'd leaked the anomalies himself. He was burning the company down in small, controlled bursts, just to keep us in a state of constant, desperate loyalty. We were so busy surviving the day that we never stopped to ask why the building was always on fire. I watched him do it to a young intern, a girl who reminded me of myself 5 years prior. He broke her in a week, spinning a web of lies about her performance until she was sobbing in the break room, convinced she was a failure. Alessandro just walked past her, adjusted his cufflinks, and smiled at me. It was a game. It was all a goddamn game to him. The cost of being in his orbit wasn't just the late nights or the gray hairs. It was the way my soul started to feel like it had been scrubbed with steel wool. I became cold. I became just like him. I started creating my own little pockets of chaos, just to feel that same rush of control. I'd withhold information from the creative team just to see them panic before a deadline, then save them at the last second. I was becoming the monster's apprentice. And the worst part was how much I liked the power it gave me. I wasn't scared anymore. I was the one making people scared. But chaos is a fickle mistress. You can only juggle so many grenades before one of them has a shorter fuse than you expected. Alessandro's downfall didn't come from a whistleblower or a grand legal gesture. It came because he finally manufactured a crisis that he couldn't control. He tried to play the board of directors against the primary shareholders, a move he'd pulled a dozen times before. But this time, he underestimated their appetite for blood. He'd created so much noise, so much internal strife, that the investors finally decided it was cheaper to gut the company than to keep fixing what he was breaking. I watched him in that final meeting. For the first time, he wasn't the one holding the match. The board chair, a woman who had seen through his friction years ago, simply laid out the numbers. The turnover rate, the litigation costs, the sheer lack of actual growth hidden behind the smoke and mirrors of his innovative leadership. Alessandro tried to pivot. He tried to flirt with the disaster, to make it look like this was all part of a larger plan. But the room was cold. The addiction had worn off. They didn't want the adrenaline anymore. They wanted an adult in the room. He was escorted out by security, a man who had built a kingdom of glass and spent his life throwing stones. As he walked past my desk, he didn't look angry. He looked bored. The game was over, and he was already looking for a new playground to set ablaze. I stayed behind, tasked with cleaning up the literal and metaphorical wreckage. I had the title I'd always wanted, the office with the view, and a staff that looked at me with the same terrified devotion they used to give him. I looked at my reflection in that same glass wall he'd thrown the glass against months ago, and I didn't recognize the woman looking back. I had survived the chaos, but I had lost the ability to live in the peace. Now, I sit in his chair. I feel the silence of a stable office, and it's deafening. I find myself reaching for the phone at midnight, wanting to call someone, wanting to plant a seed of doubt, wanting to feel that spark of friction just one more time. He didn't just teach me how to manage a workplace. He ruined me for a normal one. I'm the executive who loves chaos now. And the only thing scarier than the fire is the realization that I'm the one holding the matches.